You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 372, Revelation 7, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, lots of sevens in that title.
Yeah, really. That's true. 370 Revelation 7, part 1. It must be code for something.
Yeah, some kind of...
It's the key to unlocking the 144,000. That's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. You've tackled that, I believe, in a Q&A before. So I'm interested to hear what more
and
you
a little
add
bit,
to it.
Yeah, a little bit in reversing Hermon, too. What listeners need to do now is record this and play it backwards, and then you'll know.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, if I had sound effects, I would completely put something in there in reverse. But hey, before we get into Revelation 7, I've been meaning to ask you about your thoughts on the new Dead Sea Scroll discoveries that happened a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, I've looked around on, like, there's nothing... At least the last time I looked on the ASOR blog, that's the American Schools of Oriental Research. I can't really find anything on the academic sources, which isn't unusual because they'll wait until somebody publishes something or is near publication or presents something at, you know, one of the universities in Israel and whatnot. I'm betting this November at either SBL or the ASOR meetings that somebody will have a session on this. But, you know, The most interesting part to me is that the new stuff is in Greek, which is, again, there are Greek Dead Sea Scrolls. That's not the first time for that. But obviously you'd expect Hebrew, you know, or Aramaic, but these are in Greek, and it's part of what I've been able to find, that there's two fragments, both from minor prophets. So Zechariah 8, two verses, that's 16 and 17, then Nahum 1, 5, and 6. So it's the real small fragments, you know, whatnot. So, you know, I found a few pictures. They're just little pieces. But this is typically how they come across stuff. Cave 4 was a few hundred thousand of these pieces. If you go up online and get a picture of these, under a few inches of bat dung, you know, guano. So...
That's crazy.
They're not all these neat scrolls in jars, you know, like you see in the pictures. A lot of it's this kind of stuff, you know, just little pieces that you got to try to figure out how to join them and whatnot. But if it's biblical stuff, at least you can, you know, you can type it out, run it through a computer, and get it, speeds up the process rather than just doing it out of your head like they did in the old days. But yeah, it's interesting for sure. I mean, the nice thing is it shows there's stuff still out there, even if it's this small, but there's stuff still out there. Now, if they could only find a way of getting people on the black market to cough up what they have, that would be great. But I strongly suspect that there's stuff like that just waiting to be sold, even though people nowadays know they've got to be real careful about that, or that they don't want to end up in jail. They want to make their money but not wind up in jail. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, especially because the robbers have been happening for 60, 70 years. I mean, way before they found, you know, the first cave. So, I mean, where you think they would have already sold a lot of that stuff?
Yeah, I'm betting they did, you know, sold it to other people who aren't going to release it to the public. Yeah, private collectors. Okay. I'm sure that's going to be the case, you know, and somebody dies and, oh, look what we found, you know, going through the house, you know. So people can insulate themselves from, you know, legal problems and whatnot. But yeah, I'm sure you're right there.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be interesting. It's probably going to be after our lifetime when all this stuff hits, I would think.
Yeah. I would imagine there's going to be something, you know, like that. I don't think it'll take another 100 years to get something of, you know, significance out there, because, you know, people do pass on, they do donate things, they come clean, you know, that happens. So, you know, and even if they can manage to make a deal with someone who will release it to the public, then that other person can always say, oh, you know, I bought it from somebody on the dark web. I don't know who it is. So here it is. You know, I'm not keeping it. but there it is. You know, you can. I could see stuff like that happening.
If you're a listener of the Naked Bible Podcast out there and you've got this in your private collection, we implore you to reach out to your museum, right, Mike? Or you reach out to us. You know, we'll be happy to facilitate transfer of ownership to a museum or university.
The problem with all this, though, is the propensity of fakery. You know, like the Museum of the Bible got hammered, you know, not too long ago, right. You know, for having purchased fakes. And that, I mean, the faking is pretty sophisticated. But it's not hard to know how to do it. It's just, you know, can you get to the materials? Do you have that much patience? You know, that sort of thing to reproduce this kind of stuff. But people are scared. Well, what they do is they'll cut out. We were just watching a couple of weeks ago about something about the Mormon Church and faking Joseph Smith documents. And the guy used for the material on which the writing went, he used the same method as the old, I think it was the 60s or 70s novel by Irving Wallace, The Word. Because you get these manuscripts in museums and old libraries. And, you know, if they can get access to them, a lot of these like codexes that come from 3rd, 4th century, they have blank pages in them. You just cut one out, you know, and walk out with it. You know, you put it between something flat, you know, there you go. So yeah, go ahead and carbon date that puppy all you want. You know, you know, you're going to find out it's, you know, in the 300s AD and it's a new gospel or something, you know, that. So that's as old as, you know, Irving Wallace, but, you know, people who forge, they know how to find those things that have the extra pages and cut them out. And then it's just a matter of the chemical analysis of the ink, which is, you know, you can get that in any journal article, you know, databases online. They do that kind of analysis. And so you can make the ink. The trick is can you reproduce the handwriting? You know, that's usually where things go awry, trying to imitate a scribal hand. But the other stuff, the quote-unquote scientific stuff, you can fake that. It's not that difficult, at least in terms of what to do.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, Mike. Well, let's turn our attention back to the Bible and Revelation 7. I know you've talked
back to
about
your encrypted past. Introduction.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had some backwards.
Yeah.
You know, my name is Yurt backwards. Does that mean anything? Yurt? Kind of sounds...
Yeah, well, there is, I don't know if it's the correct spelling, but there are such things as yurts. Is that what you're talking about?
Is that like the tents, the little circle tents?
Yeah, those round, yeah, I think yurts. They're round. Yeah, round.
I was hoping
things.
Something
yeah.
more powerful, like.
Right.
Yeah. But if,
it's not
if
terribly
I'm a circle,
exotic.
If I'm a circle tent, that's not as exciting.
But. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, you're a circle tent. Wow, yeah, I'm impressed. Yeah.
That's not very.
Yeah.
I'm going to need you to. Come up with some kind of Hebrew meaning.
Yeah, Hebrew word for yurt.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I guess I'm just a number 3. Trey stands for 3, so.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm just 3. But we're in Revelation 7.
It's not quite gematria, but we'll take it. You know?
Yeah, we're in Revelation 7 today, Mike. So what more are you going to teach us about the 144,000 today?
Well, this is part one, which obviously means we're going to need more time. Don't know yet if we're going to get 3. We're going to get at least 2, obviously. In this episode, you know, we're going to tackle a few sort of, I guess, you know, transparently obvious questions when it comes to, again, repurposing the Old Testament and whatnot. And then in the next episode, we'll get into some of the odder stuff that I've actually written a little bit about, like why is Dan missing from the list of tribes and all that stuff. So we'll get back into that sort of thing and a little bit of interpretive stuff. And even here, you know, there's going to be some of that too. But, you know, this is what the passage is known for, 144,000, first 8 verses. This is the first of 2 listings of the 144,000, or, you know, 2 sections of the book of Revelation that spend any time on them. And so this is what everybody thinks of when you hit Revelation 7. And again, I did, you know, write about this before a little bit in Reversing Hermon. We're going to go beyond that, both in this episode, the next episode. So today we're not going to necessarily get into that or how the story, here's a teaser, how the text, you know, the 144,000 Mandy'd factor into the Watcher story. Again, I talk about that in Reversing Hermon, but that's for part two. But again, we'll get a little more detail than we devoted to it there. So let's, for today, just jump into the passage, the first eight verses. And again, I'm reading from ESV. It says, "After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm earth and sea, saying, 'Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads.' And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." And then you get the list, you know, 12,000 from Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin are the 12 tribes in the next four verses. They all are 12,000 and they are, quote unquote, sealed. Now, you know, a couple general observations, because we're focused here on what John is doing with the Old Testament. You know, the obvious ones are the tribes and the numbers. Okay, so let's just start with the numbers. What about all this counting? What does it remind you of in the Old Testament? Well, the answer is kind of obvious. It reminds you of census counting. I mean, you get these lists of tribes numbered in the Old Testament, like the book of Numbers. You know, what a surprise. That's immediately sort of what you think of. Now, On, in his Revelation commentary, this is again volume 2, Revelation 6 through 16, he writes this. He says, "The census is a specific form of list that occurs with some frequency in the Old Testament, where it is used for purposes of taxation, one example, Exodus 30, 11 through 16, or for labor conscription, 2 Chronicles 2, 17 and 18, for determining the cultic duties and social structure of members of the tribe of Levi, that's Numbers 3 and 4. For determining Israelite descent, you get it in Ezra 2. But most commonly, he says, it is used as a means for determining military strength. And this is Numbers chapter 1, verses 2 through 46. Again, very, very obvious parallel, if you want it, or kind of a source text for that. Now, that suggests, On writes, that the census in Revelation 7, 4 through 8 is for military purposes. And that might be a bit of an overstatement, but you could see it in the context of Revelation. And this is where On goes. I mean, he lists all these other things that don't really fit. So bad things are coming on, you know, with boots on the ground and all this sort of stuff, lots of conflict. It's an apocalyptic text. So this is a reasonable deduction. Again, he suggests that the census in Revelation 7, 4 through 8 is for military purposes, a possibility that is partially confirmed by the present literary context of this pericope, since, according to Revelation 14, that's the second mention of the 144,000, according to Revelation 14, 3 and 4, the group of 144,000 consists exclusively of adult males who practice sexual abstinence, an ancient Israelite requirement for holy warriors. Again, we're going to get into the characterization of them being male virgins next week, and we get, you know, again into more Levitical connections, possibly again having to do with the story of the Book of the Watchers in Enoch. But again, just store that away for now. Again, On is noting that this is, you know, kind of the practice before as one of the preparations for war. You know, if you didn't have sex with your wife, you know, that sort of thing. So again, he's saying this suggests we have a military context. But he also adds, however, the absence of all military and holy war imagery from Revelation 7, 4 through 8 makes this suggestion doubtful. And so he's pulling back a little bit. The author's insistence on an equal number, 12,000, from each of 12 tribes indicates his interest is in the eschatological restoration of the 12-tribe nation of Israel. The eschatology of the late Old Testament and early Jewish periods emphasized the hope of the restoration of Israel. It's Deuteronomy 30, verses 3 and 5, Isaiah 11, 11 through 16, and lots of passages here. Ezekiel 37, 15 to 23 is sort of a favorite on this podcast. again, he gives you 10, 15 references here to this hope of the restoration of Israel. And specifically, a number of these texts have the all 12 tribes included. So that's Owen's, you know, assessment. He angles for the military thing, points that out. Okay, you could see that, but then he backs away and says, restoration seems like a better way to go here. And that's actually going to go better, you know, with what where we'll land next week when we hit the whole thing about the characterization of the 144,000 as sexual virgins and, you know, male virgins and all that stuff. Bauckham also sort of pushes back on the holy war, the military context, in his article, The Book of Revelation as a Christian War Scroll. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls as we were chatting before the episode, but one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the more famous ones from the, you know, original truckload, is something called the War Scroll. It's 1QM, and this is an apocalyptic war between, you know, I like the phrase, gods and men, but you have angels and angelic beings and humans fighting on both the good side and the bad side. That's why it's known as the War Scroll, set in the end times. So Bauckham has this article comparing the Book of Revelation to the War Scroll, and again, calling the Book of Revelation a Christian War Scroll. Now, I've put this article in the protected folder just for anybody who's interested in it. We're not going to go point by point through it, but just so that you know have access to it. So Bauckham, though, he says it's a more fruitful trajectory to think about the tribes as opposed to this sort of faint military imagery. So he's going to agree with On. He doesn't really, you know, he acknowledges the military element is there, but doesn't find it that persuasive. So let's talk about the tribes. So this is the second thing that stands out, the tribes and the tribal arrangement. So Bauckham writes this. He says, the list of the 12 tribes in Revelation 7 has several peculiarities which require comment. That's an understatement, believe me. First, the order of the list corresponds to no other extant list of the tribes, period, in the Bible. Okay, this one's unique in terms of its order. Most significant, Bauckham writes, is the fact that Judah heads the list. This is true of Old Testament lists in which the tribes are arranged geographically, moving from south to north, for instance, Numbers 34:19, Joshua 21:4, so on and so forth. But the list in Revelation 7 bears no other resemblance to any of these geographical lists. The only other Old Testament list of tribes which puts Judah first is that of Numbers 2, verse 3, followed by Numbers 7, 12, and 10, 14. That is, the tribes in their military order in the camp. So again, here he is now making this comment about there's a military flavoring to this, but then Bauckham says, but again, the rest of the order of tribes in Revelation 7 bears no resemblance to the list in Numbers 2. And again, he has this, you know, his own pushback about, you know, okay, there's some military stuff in here, but not enough to make, you know, make him or On, of course, think that this is really what it's about. I don't think we should lose the military context personally. I think it does fit with spiritual warfare, which again, that's for part two with the whole Watcher story. I think there's a reason why we get some military sprinkles in the text. But continuing on with Bauckham, so he says that's one peculiarity. The order of the list corresponds to no other extant list of the tribes. Number two, the inclusion of both Joseph and Manasseh. This is Revelation 7, 6, and 8. Rather than either Joseph alone or Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, let me just stop there. Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's two boys. And so after they're sort of grafted into Israel, you know, the Genesis 48 scene with Jacob, you know, crossing the hands and all that, after they are adopted essentially by Israel, by Jacob, you will often see Ephraim and Manasseh occupying the Joseph slot in the list of tribes. But here you get both Joseph and Manasseh, like what happened to Ephraim. Bauckham actually says here, this is unparalleled and has never been explained. Thanks for that. You know, then he goes on and he says, a possibility is that the author had in mind Ezekiel 37, 15 through 23. The classic Old Testament prophecy of the reunion of the 12 tribes in the Messianic kingdom. In the extant text of Ezekiel 37, 16, and 19, the name Joseph has been glossed. There's an explanatory item in these verses. The name Joseph has been glossed with phrases referring to Ephraim. in such a way that the reader could think that Joseph is here being used as a name for the tribe of Ephraim. Joseph might therefore seem a suitable name for Ephraim in the list of the tribes in the eschatological reunited Israel. So let me just stop there. So Baucom's saying it's really unusual, and it's unprecedented, actually, that you have Joseph and Manasseh in a tribal list and you don't have Ephraim. Then to summarize what he's saying, well, if you go back in the Old Testament, you're going to find in Ezekiel 37, you're going to find references to Joseph there, because Ezekiel 37, the context is the reunification of the tribe. You're going to find Joseph there, but Joseph is talked about in ways that would be associated with Ephraim elsewhere in the Old Testament. So maybe a reader of John's Apocalypse, when he encounters Joseph in the list, will think Ephraim, and therefore you sort of have Ephraim and Manasseh. You have this expected symmetry. Okay, that's a guess, but and Baucom admits it's a guess. He says this has never really been explained by anybody. There you go. Maybe that's what's going on. Third anomaly is the tribe of Levi, Revelation 7:7, might seem out of place in a military census. It was excluded from the two Mosaic censuses. It's hard to say, censuses. In Numbers 1, 41, Numbers 2, 33, Numbers 26, 1 through 51. Okay, Levi isn't included. Remember, the census in Numbers was, again, this is for warfare, because they're going to go in and, that the conquest is going to start, we're going to take the land and all that. But the priestly tribe was excluded from that. But here they're included. It's just a little odd. I mean, in the book of Numbers, they do get numbered, but not as part of the military, engagement party, okay? And they're not part of the military forces. Baucom adds, however, in 1QM, that's the war scroll from Qumran, although the priests and Levites do not fight with weapons, they play an essential part in the conduct of war, conducting prayers before, during, and after battle, and blowing the trumpets, which both direct the troops and call divine attention to the battle. Without them, the war could not be a holy war, so they have to participate in some way, he says. Consequently, the tribe of Levi is organized on the same military pattern as the other tribes in the war scroll anyway, 1QM 4, 1 through 8, and can be said to fight, in this way. Again, this is sort of like spiritual warfare, which I think is the more fruitful trajectory for all of this. So those are, again, Baucom's, three anomalies that he notes right away when it comes to the tribes. He could have added, well, he does add, I'll just include it here, even though we're going to talk about it next time. Fourth, the omission of Dan. Okay, the tribe of Dan is not in the list in Revelation 7 or later. So the omission of Dan from the list must probably be regarded as arbitrary, Baucom says. Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. Again, part two, we'll spend more time on that. One tribe was frequently omitted in order to achieve a list of 12. That's true, because after Joseph, you have Ephraim and Manasseh. So the number goes from 12 to 13. So you gotta take one away to get this nice roundabout 12 number. So that's true, but it's still Dan. And Baucom knows all this. So he adds, the tradition that Antichrist was to come from the tribe of Dan, which is first found in Irenaeus. And then Hippolytus, again, these are early patristic writers, is unlikely. Baucom says this tradition is unlikely to be pre-Christian. In other words, he doesn't think it was part of the Jewish mindset, the Jewish cognitive environment at the time. Because or since the Antichrist figures of Jewish apocalyptic are invariably Gentile and pagan. In any case, he says, even this would scarcely account for the exclusion of the whole tribe from the eschatological Israel. So again, to summarize that, he notes the absence of Dan. That's his fourth anomaly. He thinks it's arbitrary. You got to take one out. So why not Dan? It's Dan's turn to be left out. Doesn't think there's anything to it. Again, because he's thinking that this whole idea is something that springs from Christian tradition, even though Christians use the Old Testament to get to this conclusion. He doesn't believe that it's present in Judaism. And so Baucom says, I don't think so. Again, we'll spend more time on the omission of Dan in part two. But again, there's all four anomalies. Now, again, the point for now is that it does seem fair to me that the census lists and the tribal arrangement is, sort of on target. Maybe we don't have too much or an overemphasis on the military side. Maybe it really is about the betrayals and the restoration of the tribes. I mean, I think that's legitimate. That's on target. But I don't think that that really means that the military element should just be dismissed or ignored. I think John is using that Old Testament theme as well to portray opposition on earth to the forces of evil. You know, who it's going to turn out in the book of Revelation to be this Antichrist figure in the last days. Again, so I think spiritual warfare is much more in view than anything, you know, again, boots on the ground kind of military engagement. So I think it should remain part of the picture and not just be, you know, set aside. So for the rest of this episode, though, I want to drill down on a couple of other things. Now, one of the sources that I mentioned real early on, we have not used it too much, is Stephen Moyse. It's M-O-Y-I-S-E. He, in his book on the Old Testament, in the book of Revelation, raises two obvious questions about this chapter. He writes this: the two main questions that arise from John's use of, you know, this tradition concern the identity of those protected, the 144,000, and their relation to the great throng of Revelation 7-9. Like, is it the same group or a different group? Let me just go and read that. So after you get the list of the 144,000 in Revelation 7, that list ends with verse 8. And then verse 9, we read this: after this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands. And then it can, you know, the description continues. But anyway, there are scholars who think that the great throng there is the 144,000, and others, and I'm including myself in this group, don't. I don't think they're from the tribes of Israel. I think that excludes them right away. I think you have two different groups here. But Moyse is saying the two questions are: who are these guys? Who are the 144,000? And, you know, what's the relationship to verse 9? And number two, second question: what is it that they are protected from? Okay, so let's take those two in order. So who are the 144,000, this identification? Moyse, again, will start us off again from the same source, his book on the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. He writes this: the sealing of the saints in Revelation 7, 2, and 3 is almost certainly modeled on Ezekiel 9, 4 through 6. So I'm going to read Ezekiel 9, 4 through 6, because he doesn't give you the full passage. He has an excerpt here, but let me just go there and read Ezekiel 9, because, again, I think this for sure is John's source material. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to start in verse 1, Ezekiel 9, and read through verse 6. Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, bring near the executioners of the city. Okay, if you remember way back in our series on Ezekiel, in chapter 8, you get this vision of the abominations of the temple, all the stuff that the people are doing wrong, you know, and God is angry and so on and so forth. And so Ezekiel hears the voice of God. He cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, bring near the executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen and with a writing case at his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub on which it rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing case in his waist. And the Lord said to him, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. And to the others, he said in my hearing, pass through the city after him, you know, after the first guy, and strike. Your eye shall not spare. You shall show no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, children and women, and touch no one on whom is the mark. And I begin at my sanctuary, you know, with the priests. So they began with the elders who were before the house. That's first six verses. So you have this judgment scene in Ezekiel, again, basically for the thoroughgoing apostasy, not only of the priesthood and the temple, but the whole city. So Moyse says this is, it's pretty hard to not see this as John's point of reference. So he writes, and he quotes this passage: go through the city, through Jerusalem, put a mark on the foreheads of those who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. Right? Touch no one who has the mark. And then he compares that with Revelation 7, 2, and 3. I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to damage earth and sea, saying, do not damage the earth or the sea or the trees until we have marked the servants of our God, and you know, with a seal on their foreheads. So Moy says, later tradition identified the sealing either with baptism, the laying on of hands, or the marking of the cross. This is later Christian tradition. And perhaps Paul's use of sphragidzein, it's a specific verb in 2 Corinthians 1:22. It means to certify or seal. So 2 Corinthians 1:22, Ephesians 1:13, Ephesians 4:30. And Moy says Paul's use of sphragidzein in these passages made this later tradition inevitable. Nevertheless, he says, it seems clear that John's meaning is closer to Ezekiel's. I mean, Paul, let me just butt in here. Paul doesn't have sealing going on for some sort of purpose that would kind of align with the sealing of Ezekiel 9. You know, like that they're not being protected physically from something. Okay, and Paul's. So Moise is saying John seems to be going the same direction as Ezekiel. He's not tracking with Paul, he's tracking with Ezekiel. So he keeps writing and says, again, it seems clear that John's meaning is closer to Ezekiel's, namely that God's people are to be given a special mark to protect them from the approaching slaughter. One further point of interest is that the sealing episode is followed by an angel reaching into the altar and hurling fire onto the earth. Quote, then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth, Revelation 8:5, unquote. A similar thing follows Ezekiel's account of the sealing. Quote, this is 10:2. He said to the man clothed in linen, go within the wheelwork underneath the cherubim, fill your hands with burning coals from among the cherubim and scatter them over the city. Unquote. So Moses is saying, look, even this element's there. So it would seem clear that the sealing is drawn from a Jewish text, Ezekiel 9, and wider Jewish context, the tribes and the census. Arguably the main factor in the identity of the 144,000, again, being the tribes, the restoration of the tribes. So On, again, is aware of all this, and he notes as much, but he sort of adds a little twist. So let me add his thought here. He says, many who think that Revelation 7, 4 through 8 is based on a Jewish source hold that while the 144,000 may have originally referred to Jews or the real Israel, i.e. the ethnic Israel, that source has been reinterpreted by the author, John, to refer to a different group, such as the Christian church or Christian martyrs. There are others, however, who think that whether or not Revelation 7, 4 through 8 is based on a Jewish source, the text in its present context refers to Jews. So right there you have a difference of opinion. And On lays it out. Even though this goes back to Ezekiel 9, he says, some scholars think John's reinterpreting it and applying it to Christians. And then there are others who would say, nope, these are all Jews. The 144,000 are Jews. They're not Gentile, in other words. See, and catch the way I said that. Because right away, even in the academic discussion, there's an odd mixing up or conflation of the term Christian and Jew. Okay, a Christian. You know, look, you can still be a Christian, you can still be a believer and be a Jew or a Gentile. But historically, again, in the history of interpretation, scholars have looked at this and saying, oh, ethnic Jews, that's one, you know, one group. The other one says, nope, they're Christian church. Well, can't they still be Jews? I mean, if their followers are of Jesus, aren't they Christians anyway? But again, it seems like a lot of people don't even ask that question, which is kind of shocking, to be honest with you. But On is correct here. These are the two sides that historically have been taken. 144,000 are Jews. 144,000 are not Jews. So like it's this black and white either or thinking. And I'm going to end up objecting to this as we go on. So I think you can already tell that. But that's typically how this is laid out. So On goes into, okay, why does each side take its position? You know, what are the arguments? You know, should we stick with the context of Ezekiel 9, Jews, or should we do something different with it? Okay, should we assume that John is altering it when he uses it? Or is John being consistent, again, with his use of it? You know, where do we fall out here? So On writes this. He says, there are several arguments that proponents of this view, as far as the Jewish view, put forward. A, the detailed enumeration of 12,000 sealed from each of the 12 tribes of Israel suggests that Jews or Jewish Christians are in view. See, now he throws that in. That's his safety net. Jews or Jewish Christians are in view. Okay, but they're still ethnic Jews. And I'm actually going to agree with that qualification. I think they are ethnic Jews, but I also think they're followers of the Lamb. They're believers. They're Christians. Okay, so let's try to keep the terminology straight here. So his first argument, again, for that view is, look, 12,000 from each tribe. Okay, that's what's in view. For while the 12 tribes in dispersion, James 1:1, for instance, can be used in a Christian context to represent the whole Christian church, inclusive of Gentiles, he says, a detailed enumeration of 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes does not lend itself easily to allegorization, which is, I don't know why he calls it that, but okay, we'll just let him go. B, his second argument, since the author is undoubtedly a Jewish Christian, it is not particularly surprising that he would have envisioned a special role in the eschaton for Christians of Jewish origin. That's easy enough. Paul struggled with the problem of the rejection of the gospel by most Jews in Romans 9 through 11. Recognizing that not everyone descended from Israel belongs to the true Israel, Romans 9:6. Yet nevertheless, Paul held out the eschatological hope that Israel would eventually be converted, Romans 11:25 through 27. The eschatological tradition of the future gathering of Israel and the Gentiles at the New Jerusalem at the coming of Christ is found elsewhere in early Christian literature. See, now here he's getting confusing because now he's looping the Gentiles in. You know, I don't know why he does this. What I want you as the listener to know, look, here are your options for the 144,000. All ethnic Jews having nothing to do with their status as Christians, which doesn't seem possible, okay? Because they're followers of the Lamb. The Lamb is Jesus. Second is, they're all Christians with no Jewish ethnicity. Again, to me, that's possible, but it doesn't seem right. To me, that the better option is, okay, they're Jews, they're ethnic Jews, but they're Christians too. We don't have to have the Gentiles in the picture because, again, my view that you're going to hear in a moment is when you get to verse 9, the massive multitude from every tribe, every nation, those are the Gentiles. Okay, so, and these two groups, the 144,000 and the massive group in Revelation 7, and they're on the same side. It's just two different ways of talking about the composition of the people of God. So to me, this doesn't seem like so much of a dilemma. But I want you to hear the academic discussion, because even the academic discussion is like, well, you say one thing, then you say another, then you mix the two. And it just gets really confusing, where I don't think it really has to be that confusing. So Owen keeps going on, and then he's going to talk about the other view. Okay, the one that sort of, I think, should we say, lands on this, oh, they're all Christians. Really, there's nothing to see here with, you know, Jewish ethnicity. So opponents of the first view have proposed a number of arguments against interpreting the 144,000 as Jews or Jewish Christians. So the second view wants to see them as the church, mixture of Jew and Gentile, and no attention is being drawn. The second view says that the church is the new Israel anyway, so Jewish ethnicity is not even part of what's going on here. So those who defend that view say the 12 tribes did not literally exist in the first century AD. I mean, nobody knew their tribal affiliation, okay? And the hope of their eventual restoration belonged not to the real, but to the ideal world. Against this objection, you know, Owen's going to push back here because he doesn't buy this, and neither do I, so I'm going to let you have it here with him. Against this objection, it can be countered that Josephus, writing at the end of the first century, reckoned with the existence of 12 tribes in his day. So Josephus would have disagreed. Well, we do have people here who know what tribe they're from here in the first century. And Josephus, you know, talked about the widespread eschatological hope of the regathering of the 12 tribes of Israel, which was certainly based on the assumption of their actual existence in the world. Why else would you hope for it? You know, if there were no tribes at all, nobody knew what are you talking about tribes for? You know, well, then it wouldn't have been a big item of discussion in terms of the apocalyptic literature, the religious literature, but it was. Secondly, the distinction between Jewish Christianity and Gentile Christianity, common in the early decades of the apostolic age, was no longer current at the end of the first century. Again, I doubt that too, and so does On. He says, against this position, it may be argued that the debate between Christianity and Judaism continued well into the second century, as is evident in Barnabas and the Dialogue of Justin Martyr. Third, so many of the ways of describing the real Israel have been applied to the church in Revelation that it would be perverse to treat Revelation 7, 4 through 8 as an exception to the rule. To this, it may be replied that while certain Old Testament language used of Israel is applied to Christians, okay, Christians are called, you know, just generally, the church, believers generally, are called a kingdom and a kingdom of priests, an allusion to Exodus 19:6, and this is found in Revelation 1:6, 5:10, so on and so forth. Sure, that happens. But Owen says the use of other traditional language in Revelation suggests that the church is constituted of both Jews and Gentiles, i.e. the 12 gates of the New Jerusalem bear the names of the 12 tribes, the sons of Israel, while the 12 foundations of the city bear the names of the 12 apostles. And so in other words, he's saying, look, they're on the same side, but there are passages that distinguish them too. So don't just, you know, jam all of them together. So these are the two sides. Now, you know, On is on the side that these 144,000 either are ethnic Jews or Jewish Christians. And that's, my position is that they're Jewish Christians. Okay. This would seem coherent in light of the transition at Revelation 7:9. So On is going to argue for this. And I'm in agreement with him. He says there are striking differences between the two groups described in Revelation 7:4-8, 144,000, and Revelation 7:9-17, the rest of the chapter, that have to be borne in mind. Number one, there's a clear contrast between the specific enumeration of the 144,000 and the, quote, vast size of a great multitude, which, quote, no one was able to number. Well, it can't be the same because they just numbered them back in verses 4-8. So how does it make any sense to say that the massive group in verses 9-17 is the same as the 144,000? Well, it doesn't. The latter is obviously a much larger group than the former, and therefore very probably a different group. Second, On says, the 144,000 are composed of 12,000 drawn from each of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel, while the members of the great multitude, in explicit contrast, according to verse 9, are drawn from, quote, every nation and tribe and people and language group, unquote. It's very obvious. Third, the 144,000 are apparently located on earth, while the innumerable multitude is in heaven, before the throne of God, Revelation 7:11. Again, that's pretty obvious too. Fourth, in Revelation 7:4-8, the 144,000 are in a situation of imminent peril that requires protective sealing, while the innumerable multitude of 7:9-17 has passed victoriously through the great tribulation and has received a heavenly reward. Obviously, they weren't sealed because they're dead. All right. They've suffered, okay? So for my money, it makes more sense to have the 144,000 as Jews who are also Christians. They're loyal to the Lamb. They are Christians, but the Old Testament orientation suggests they should not be thought of as Gentiles. Gentiles are not included in this group. Again, they're not spiritual Israelites. They're Jews who follow the Lamb. Everything about Revelation 7:1-8 is Jewish and Old Testament in context. What does John repurpose? The census stuff, the tribes, and Ezekiel 9. I mean, everything is pointing this direction. So again, in part two, we're going to also throw in Levitical elements here as well when we get to, again, the whole issue of how does this possibly connect to the Watcher story. So I think Revelation 14 also is consistent with this. This is the other passage with 144,000, are mentioned. I don't see a contrast between that 144,000 and this 144,000. Again, some scholars argue the two groups are different, asserting that the 144,000 in Revelation 14 cannot be Jews, which makes zero sense in my mind. The only possible basis for such a conclusion is that the 144,000 in Revelation 14 are not listed by tribes. Okay, well, why would John need to do that twice? He's already done it once. In Revelation 7, why does he have to do it again? Again, this is John. He's not that neat. I mean, we've seen this, you know, countless times already. John just assumed... You know, the same guy that assumes that you're going to be able to pluck out the four or five phrases from four or five different books of the Old Testament and know what he's doing with it and why, he probably expects you to remember something seven chapters ago in the same document that he's writing. So to me, this is really a lame, you know, sort of trajectory to try to distinguish one group from the other. The other thing that it says, well, the ones in chapter 14, they follow the Lamb. Well, so do these. I mean, lots of ethnic Jews followed the Lamb, followed Christ. Doesn't mean they aren't Jews. They don't lose their ethnicity. Again, this whole objection seems to confuse a spiritual label, Christian, okay, follower of the Lamb, with an ethnic one, Jew. None of this, again, requires the notion that John intends to keep Jewish and Gentile believers separate, because elsewhere he's going to put everybody together in one people of God and so on and so forth. So my advice here, my little end times system jab of the day is pretty simple. Look, don't take the 144,000 and use their Jewish ethnicity to argue for a particular end times system that keeps the Jew, the Jewish believer, absolutely separate from the Gentile or the circumcision neutral thing we call the church, because John is going to join them elsewhere. Okay, and vice versa. Don't, for another end time system, take the merging passages and argue against the separation passages. This is typically what's done with end time systems. People pick the trajectory on which their system works best, and then they look back at the places where it doesn't work and they call them problem passages. Okay, let's just not do that. So Beale, again, gets into this a little bit. I'm not going to read everything that Beale has because, you know, Beale, well, maybe I should, because Beale wants everything to be the church, right? He's reformed, you know, he wants everything to be the church. So I'll just read you what he has here. He says, some commentators understand the number 144,000 as literal and conclude that those who are sealed are a remnant of the ethnic Israelites. Again, why does it have to be that way, Dr. Beale? Why can't it be a group of Jewish Christians? But anyway, to be fair to him, this is how it is articulated, so that is fair. So the number of them conclude that must be a remnant of ethnic Israelites. This is a typical dispensational approach, for instance, which Beale is not. He says, this is based on the presupposition that John's language is to be understood literally except where he states explicitly otherwise. It is also usually based on the futurist understanding of the book's structure. That's dispensationalism. According to which Revelation 4:1 all the way through 22:5 refers only to a future tribulation immediately preceding Christ's second coming. Accordingly, Revelation 7:4-8 is said to allude to a group of ethnic Israelites who come to believe in Christ during this tribulation period. So in other words, they're not even believers when they're sealed. They come to believe. In a dispensational system, or at least some of them anyway. You know, and then they'll get protected from martyrdom during it. It's unwise, again, to take the separation aspects, argue one end time system, and then ignore the places where they're merged. You know, I'm sorry, but Old Testament imagery like the kingdom of priests. The Old Testament passages about ethnic Israel are applied to all believers in the book of Revelation, in the letters to the churches, where very clearly they're not just Jews there, okay? That does happen in the book. So let's not just skip those to create our system and then call them problem passages or just ignore them. That's cheating. Okay, don't do that. This is why I say again, you know, we'll add this to the very long list of how all systems of eschatology cheat somewhere. They just do. You know, that's just the way it is. So I would, again, I'm going to skip a little bit here to what Beale says elsewhere. Again, Beale wants everything to be the church here. It should be obvious from this that the separation of Jews and Gentiles as believers must be married to assumptions about Revelation, describing a future tribulation period. So Beale notes, some commentators link Revelation 7:3-8 to the prophecy in Romans 11:24-26 that all ethnic, again, this is an assumption that he's shooting at, all ethnic Israel will be saved at Christ's second coming. Most holding this view attach figurative significance to the number 144,000. So isn't this wonderful? I mean, I'm glad I included this because look, do you realize what I just read there? Beale is, and again, I grew up in this tradition, and this actually does, you will actually read this, you actually encounter this, that there are going to be those who say, look, Revelation 7 is only Jews, and they're going to come to know the Lord or whatever during the tribulation, because the tribulation is against the Jew because the church has been raptured, okay? And this is a fulfillment of Romans 11:24-26 that all Israel will be saved. So on the one hand, they're looking at it literally, that the 144,000 are literally ethnic Jews, but then when they go to Romans 11, they can't be literal there because it says all Israel. And here in Revelation 7, you got 144,000. So we don't like the subset because Romans 11 says all Israel. So the number of the passage we're taking literally must be figurative. Ta-da! So basically you get to argue your position from the same passage where part of it is literal and the other part's figurative. Just pardon my spasm. This is why I dislike eschatology so much. Because I don't like cheating with outliers. I don't like cheating method. That's what this is. And, you know, it's not just, you know, that particular, you know, end time system. You get it on the other side too. You know, with assumptions about the church being the Israel as opposed to a new Israel, you know, and the terminology matters. I mean, we've had podcast episodes on this before. The text does both, folks. It does both things. Because the one people of God is composed of two units, we'll call them. You have ethnic Jews who follow Jesus, and you have Gentiles who follow Jesus. They are two different things, but collectively they are one. So let's just own that, and when they become one, their ethnicity isn't erased. The fact that the two become one doesn't mean that God has no... There isn't a single element, eschatologically speaking, of any of God's plans for national Israel. Again, that how do we know that? There are certain passages that seem to suggest it. You know, how about Armageddon? Again, it's a battle for Jerusalem. I would suggest that Jerusalem is in Israel. You know, there are just things like this that seem ethnic Israel focused. You know, there's a lot that isn't because of the one new man idea, the one, you know, one people of God. But there's still these outliers, and we need to let the outliers be outliers. We need to affirm both rather than find some way to make them disappear and be grafted in. You see what I did there with Romans, you know. They're grafted into our theological system. And it's just tactically, it's just not. Another Jewishism. It's not kosher. It just isn't. Anyway, but this is what you get with 144,000 discussions. So let's go down a little bit here. You know, Beale wants, again, to have everything be the church. He says, if Gentile believers are clearly identified together with the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel as part of the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21, 12, and 14, and 24, and Revelation 22, 2 through 5, then it is not odd that John should refer to them together with Jewish Christians in Revelation 7, 4 as the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. Well, okay, that's coherent in that you can see how he gets there, but it's not conclusive. Why can't we allow John to do both? Why does it have to be one or the other? There's one family of God, and it's a point of factuality that in the early church and New Testament theology, the one family derived from Jewish believers and Gentiles. There's no cosmic law that says that John can't talk about the one family in both ways. Okay, for example, you know, Acts does it all the time, as do the epistles, Jewish believers and Gentile believers, okay? There's still one church. You know, when Paul talks about Jews who follow Jesus, then he talks about his Gentile, you know, friends. Did he just say that he doesn't believe that the church is one? No, of course not. It's ridiculous. Why can't John be talking both ways about the same single entity as well? The honest answer is there's no rule against it. The only thing against it is the effort to prop up a system. That's what's against it. Why not apply the already but not yet? Why not? You know, if the Lamb in the book of Revelation is risen and ruling in some way but not enthroned until Revelation 21, you know, we've seen this in a prior episode. Why is it not reasonable to think that John delays the full picture of Gentiles being identified with the 12 tribes until Revelation 21 as well? Can't John do that? Can it be already but not yet? Again, my view is, yeah, it can. It can. So I don't find Beale's arguments persuasive here either. Second question. We've got to keep moving here. Are the 144,000 specifically protected? Are they specially protected? Again, no surprise, you get more than one view of this too. So some samples are in order. Beale writes this. Why God seals his servants is debated. The main alternatives are, number one, for protection from physical harm. Number two, for protection from demons, number three, for protection from losing their faith and hence their salvation. Okay, so Beale says, you know, basically he's saying I've encountered all three of these reasons here. Moise, again, bring him back into discussion. He writes this at the same question about the special protection. As to the sealing of the 144,000, it does not appear to be protection against physical attacks. So he's out of the gate denying that it's protection against anything physical. Given that they have already had to endure the effects of the first six seals, which is kind of an assumption. Neither is it likely to be protection against death, since Revelation consistently portrays martyrdom as the way to victory. Charles, that's R.H. Charles, who was the big New Testament and Enoch scholar of a century ago, Charles thinks it is protection against the satanic forces about to be unleashed. And he cites Revelation 9, you know, the abyss passage. Though one might have expected it to come directly before this instead of before the trumpets. So, you know, Moise is saying, you know, the difference of opinion here. On, let's loop him in, sees things in a different way. He acknowledges, you know, the other perspective. He says the seal of God explicitly provides special protection for the wrath of God that is coming upon the world. And he cites Revelation 9:4. There is no explicit indication that the sealed are not protected from the wrath of the ungodly, even though this is the claim of many commentators. In many early Christian texts, the eschatological tribulation was thought to be a present feature of Christian experience in the world, and no distinction was made between plagues and punishments sent by God upon humankind and the hostility and persecution inflicted on Christians by Jews. So there's your spectrum of opinion. Now, I think, for my money, I think Beale's note, he has a note about Ezekiel 9, and I think it's pretty decisive here, though with one qualification. So Beale writes this. Beale's the only one of these three that loops Ezekiel 9 into the protection question, oddly enough. He says, Ezekiel 9 is often correctly proposed as the best background for the divine sealing. And I would agree. There God commands an angel to put a mark on all genuine believers, but instructs other angels to slay unfaithful Israelites. The mark on believers is to protect them from the coming wrath, which will be inflicted by the Babylonians, and which unfaithful Israelites will suffer. Ezekiel 9, like Ezekiel 14, 20, or 12 through 23, apparently speaks of the physical protection of the righteous remnant within Israel, who have been purged from the unfaithful by the fire of judgment. This is confirmed by the same function of the mark of blood over the Hebrews' doors at Passover. So he loops Passover in here, Exodus 12. Which may stand behind Ezekiel 9 itself. He's saying Passover might actually be behind Ezekiel 9, as well as behind Revelation 7, as is evident from the fact that the seal protects believers from the harmful effects of the following trumpet and bowl plagues, which have been modeled on the Exodus plagues. Let me just stop there. You see why I think this is decisive. You know, it's like he's looping Passover in here because the next chapter is going to do that. As the trumpet and bowl, you know, judgments get rolled out here in the book of Revelation, the 144,000 are going to be protected from them just as the faithful Israelites were at Passover. And it matters for this question that those judgments, the trumpet and bowl plagues, are modeled after the plagues of Exodus, the book of Exodus, leading up to the Passover, the death angel. So Beale's saying, look, you got to consider all of this data. Back to him, he says, spiritual protection of the Israelite faithful may also be included in these two Old Testament texts. Whichever may be the case in Ezekiel or Exodus, uppermost in John's mind is certainly not physical security, but protection of the believer's faith and salvation from the various sufferings and persecutions that are inflicted on them, whether by Satan or by his demonic or earthly agents. Do you see what Beale just did there? He builds this physical argument about protection, modeled after the association with the plagues, and then he turns away from it, and now he makes it spiritual protection. I just want you to be as frustrated as I am. Okay. Because it's like, man, you know, you're right there, you got Ezekiel 9, you got the Passover, you got the plagues, and you know, Goshen and all this stuff, you know, okay, it's not perfect, it's not a perfect parallel or even a perfect argument. But there's obviously a physical element at least in here. And then he just turns around and goes the other direction. you know, and ultimately Beale's going to argue that this is, you know, reaction from spiritual forces, and you know, he's a Calvinist, so he doesn't, you know, think that has a very low view of what he thinks is the concept of losing salvation here. So he's going to use this material against that. So it's really unsatisfying that he does such a nice job of providing some Old Testament context for a physical element and then just doesn't go there. It's just odd. You know, if protection here means protection from, you know, losing faith, then he has to see the 144,000 as the whole church, which is his view. Again, he, from a few minutes ago, you know, he doesn't want to see them only as Jewish believers. He wants to see it as the whole church. And if you do that, then you're going to look at it this way, that we're protected from apostasy here, you know, spiritual attacks and so on and so forth. But the very data that he uses could be used to go the other way. So I just, you know, again, it's a little unsatisfying as to what is done with this material. I think to sum up here, I think the best way to look at the 144,000 is, again, these are ethnic Jews. I think John's description is deliberate. I think he's using the census, the tribes, Ezekiel 9, again, as a parallel to them. He loops, the biggest argument for me is Revelation 7, 9, because it's very clear that the group that is in verses 9 through the end of the chapter is different than the one in the first 8 verses. First 8 verses, very clear Old Testament, i.e. Israelite Jewish elements there to portray this group. And after that point, verse 9 and onwards, you don't have any of that. Every tribe, every people, every language, every nation, and it can't be numbered. So how can it be that, you know, how can it be what you see in the first 8 verses? Doesn't make any sense to me. So if you have this distinction, to me that opens the door to not only Ezekiel 9 being about some sort of, you know, physical protection there, but also I think Beale's observations about Passover are legit. Now, if you think about the Exodus plagues, okay, let's just, you know, not all of them, you know, sort of totally exempted the Israelites. After all, the last one, death of the firstborn, they had to go into their house, they had to put the blood on the lintel. I mean, otherwise they would have died. So there's no like necessary immunity there. You gotta do what the Lord tells you to do to avoid physical harm. You have to take that mark, okay, on the house, you know, house door, doorposts and lintel. So there's that element of the plague of darkness. I mean, when we went through Exodus, you know, I pointed out that in some of these, it's very clear that Israel didn't suffer whatever the plague was. But in other cases, that's not said, or it would be almost impossible to see how it could be like the plague of darkness. It's dark, okay? I mean, there's no like spotlight shining on Goshen. I mean, you never see that. So even with those qualifications, though, there's clearly at least an element of physical protection in the plague accounts that I do think, because as we go keep going through Revelation, what happens to people, and the 144,000 are now part of this group, what happens to them is modeled after the plagues. And some of those, the believers did not suffer them. So I think you've got to just honor that rather than just saying, oh, it's all about, you know, losing your faith or something like that. No. Why? Again, why marshal the argument and eliminate that possibility? For sure, it's spiritual warfare. Okay, that, again, that's going to be obvious. You know, any threat to have somebody, you know, surrender the faith, you know, or become, you know, go drift off into unbelief, of course that's a spiritual, you know, warfare issue, of course. And you're going to get demonic forces that are described in the book of Revelation, of course. But why is it that we sort of run from some of the, you know, some of these other elements? I don't think it's very consistent. I think, you know, the other reason why Beale does it is because, again, he wants to move as far away as he can from, you know, let's be honest, cartoonish interpretations of the book of Revelation. I get that. But that really isn't an excuse to deny the parallels that you've just helped us see. Why would you do that? I mean, give me a good reason. Here's this reason I understand. You don't want to, you know, again, go to fantasy land here. But on the other hand, they're still there. The parallels are still there. So why can't we, why must we cancel that out? Why can't we just hold that up and say, look, this could be an element right here? Now, again, if you're looking at the book of Revelation as something already fulfilled, or at least, you know, 99% fulfilled in the first century, i.e. with the temple destruction, 70 AD, well, then you can't you really can't do anything with the parallels to the Exodus plagues. Where would the evidence be that Jews who followed Jesus were protected when the Romans came into town and destroyed the temple? I mean, I don't know where you're going to argue that. So that, you know, that sort of takes that away from you. But for anyone who's not in that position, a non-preterist view, and who wouldn't be sort of seeing any of this, or who's willing to see at least some of this be like a boots on the ground, you know, reality. Maybe not Hal Lindsey or something like that, okay? But if you're at least willing to see, again, real-time stuff in what's in the content of the book of Revelation preceding the second coming and all that, it would seem to me that this still has to be on the table. You know, this possibility at least, let's just call it a possibility at least, that the our examination of the Old Testament and its connections into Revelation renders this a possibility as far as, you know, how to look at things. So I think we need to let it there, just leave it there and not try to argue it away or cancel it out, because I think the text opens that door and leaves it open. I don't think there's any way to successfully exegetically cancel it out. So that's all I'm trying to say. So next time we're going to get into part two, and we'll hit the elements of Revelation 7 that get into the whole issue of how this might relate to the Book of the Watchers. And there's, if you've read Reversing Hermon, you're going to know some of the source material. I'll take us back into there. The Dan and the Antichrist thing, we'll get into that a little bit more. So that'll be what we cover in part two, and we should be able to wrap up Revelation 7 in that second part.
All right, Mike, we've got our homework to read Reversing Hermon again. So that's
just rush right out there and buy.
That's right. If you don't have it, you need to get to Amazon and buy Reversing Hermon right now.
Get it before Amazon pulls it, right?
Absolutely. And get it before the next episode. So there's your homework. Yeah. All right, Mike, looking forward to the next episode. I always love it when we get into the Watchers. Watchers are some of our favorite topics. I don't know why we like them so much, but maybe we should.
Yeah, well,
maybe.
What can I say? You know, it's, yeah, I mean, I understand. I understand, but it's still a little creepy, but yeah. There we go.
Exactly. All right, Mike. We'll be looking forward to part two next week. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.